You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of August, 2013, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with a Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears. We'll talk Typhoon Utor, a growing rivalry between Hong Kong and Singapore, and the decline of the written word in China.
And in Congo, one of two Norwegian citizens imprisoned on murder charges has died in his cell. Our Africa correspondent Tristan McConnell spoke to both men when they were first jailed. He will tell us more about their murky story.
Plus, we'll continue our preview of Monocle's September issue. Today we get a taste
what are you doing, Dom?
Of Japanese whiskey. It didn't strike me until then quite what that sounded like. We'll also be in Istanbul to meet a couple who might just be the future of design.
Initially, I'm a book designer. I design books and that's what I'm specialized on. But on the two most recent years, we've started working with the space, meaning the exhibition design, display structures, and the navigation systems.
Also, for all you Johnsons, Griffiths, and even Reynolds out there, listen up. We'll be speaking to the author of a new book who gives meaning behind those last names.
All that, plus we'll check in with our woman in Berlin. We will take a look at some of the European front pages. We will even play some music too. As ever, that is your hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Mr. Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Egypt's state media say the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Badi, has been arrested in Cairo. Officials say the 70-year-old was detained at a flat in Nasser City after security forces received a tip-off. He'd been on the run from the authorities who've arrested dozens of Muslim Brotherhood members in a security crackdown. The state of emergency is in place across the country following the crackdown, which has killed hundreds of supporters of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi. The United States says it hasn't yet made a decision on whether to freeze economic assistance to Egypt. The State Department said a review of all aid to the country was underway. Spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the review also applied to military and security assistance.
To be clear, we have not made a policy decision to put a blanket hold on economic support, on the Economic Support Fund, ESF, assistance. Clearly, that review is ongoing, as we've talked about in here quite a bit. That review includes military assistance, security assistance, and it also includes economic assistance. But we have not made a decision to put a blanket hold.
And the State Department has announced that one of its leading diplomats and the U.S. ambassador to Syria will meet a Russian delegation in The Hague next week to discuss plans for a peace conference to end the civil war in Syria. The State Department did not offer a specific date for the meeting, but said Wendy Sherman, Undersecretary for Political Affairs, would attend along with the U.S. Ambassador Robert Ford. The Russian delegation is likely to include Deputy Foreign Minister Gennady Gatilov and... beg your pardon... Mikhail Bogdanov. A court in Pakistan has formally indicted the former military dictator Pervez Musharraf for the murder of the former Premier Benazir Bhutto, who was assassinated in 2007. At a brief hearing in the city of Rawalpindi, Musharraf was charged with murder, conspiracy to murder, and facilitation of murder. He denies all three charges, which his lawyer says were fabricated. Bhutto was killed in a gun and suicide bomb attack after an election rally weeks after she returned to Pakistan from years in self-imposed exile. A Palestinian man has been killed and two others wounded after Israeli troops opened fire during a raid on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Doctors at a hospital in Jenin said 20-year-old Majed Lahlou was killed with a bullet to his heart. The wounded man also suffered gunshot wounds. Eyewitnesses said the Israeli troops entered the narrow street to the Jenin camp at dawn, apparently seeking to arrest a local resident. Palestinian youth threw stones at the soldiers, who responded with live gunfire. A train has killed at least 37 people who were crossing a railway track in eastern India's Bihar state. Officials say passengers then beat the driver unconscious, attacked other staff, and set fire to a carriage. The incident occurred on Monday morning when the train, the Raja Rani Express, was on its way to the provincial capital Patna from Sahasa town. Most of the dead were pilgrims on their way to attend a religious festival. India's Railway Minister M. Mallikarjun Kharg says the driver tried to stop the train when he saw the people on the track.
The loco pilot, after passing home signal, which was on a curvature, saw some persons standing on the track and applied emergency brakes. However, by the time train stopped, some persons got run over, as per the last information.
The US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and his Chinese counterpart have announced expanded bilateral exchanges and joint military exercises as the two countries tackle differences in the areas of Asia-Pacific and cybersecurity. Mr. Hagel said the measures agreed involved setting up institutions intended to build trust between the two countries.
Working groups for every general area of challenge. Senior level leadership exchanges, which I noted a number in my remarks, as did General Chong. Those are the forums that you build in order to address great challenges and issues and differences between our countries. And that's what we're doing.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much. It is 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today is our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. Welcome to the show, Aisha. Many parts of China and even Hong Kong still cleaning up, though, after Typhoon Uto. What can you tell us on the latest?
Indeed. So I was out of Hong Kong last week and I missed Typhoon Uto hitting, but it did hit the city, well, passed by the city on Wednesday and then made landfall in Guangdong province in southern China, and then also then again in the northeastern province of Liaoning. It's now said that around 100 people have been confirmed dead and 100 people, just over 100 people have been confirmed missing. It's a huge problem. The extent of the floods is great. 3.7 million people have been affected by the floods, and the Chinese President Xi Jinping has called for an all-out effort to help the flood victims.
What sort of levels of preparedness were there, Aisha? Was the nation as prepared as it could be?
I assume so. I can't speak for what happened in Guangdong province, but I did manage to keep my weather alerts on my phone when I was even out of Hong Kong last week. And Hong Kong is very prepared for typhoons. They're very good at handling them, at least compared to what I experienced in New York during Hurricane Sandy. I think Hong Kong is a much better place to be when something like this hits. So the streets were empty. Offices were closed. Our shop manager, Alicia, in Hong Kong managed to come in, and she was, you know, keeping the Monocle doors open. But everyone else pretty much went home. And the streets were empty. I assume similar precautions take place over the border in mainland China too.
Well, let's talk about China and what exactly happened there in the Guangdong province. Many people have been killed because of that typhoon. Has there been much criticism about the reaction from the Chinese government and emergency authorities?
The government have really gone all in on saying that there needs to be support. On Sunday, there was a huge emergency response from the National Disaster Reduction Commission and the Ministry of Civil Affairs. Now, this is news from the People's Daily, so you can obviously take this with a pinch of salt, but they're saying that the local government are sending 1,500 tents, 4,700 folding beds, and importantly, apparently, 3,000 cotton sheets to the disaster zones. There is clear government response going on, but seeing as people are still dealing with the floods, it's hard to see what will need to be done. One of the biggest impacts has been the Guangzhou railway station, which is the main transportation hub for the south, has suspended all its train services, and train service will partially resume today, with only 16 long distance trains expected to leave the city from today onwards.
I guess we have those sort of short-term immediate problems like transport and housing, and then you have the sort of more mid to long-term problems, the result of something like this, which is, I guess, farmland having been destroyed has a big knock-on effect further down the economic chain.
Indeed. Well, there's been a forced relocation of over 300,000 people. So that's obviously going to have a huge impact on the region moving forward. And as you say, nearly 800,000 hectares of farmland have been destroyed. I think the biggest worry is that if the dikes and the reservoirs have been breached, we are now in storm season in this part of the world. So continuing rains through September or October could lead to constant flooding and a very difficult situation in patching up what's been done by Typhoon Uttur.
And Aisha, let's move on to another story, which is really quite fascinating. There's a game show there on CCTV, the state broadcaster, called Chinese Characters Dictation Competition. Tell us about this and some of the findings from this this game show.
Catchy title.
Indeed, exactly. I'm sure all Monocle 24 listeners will be tuning in to CCTV to watch this. So I think it takes the kind of tone that many of the kind of American spelling bees that became very popular do. And what it is, it's 32 teams from middle schools across mainland China, Taiwan and Hong Kong who are competing to spell Chinese characters. It seems like a silly idea, but over the last couple of episodes, less than half of the adults who were selected from the audience to participate could write correctly the words for things like thick, so or toad. So it's clear that there's a massive problem in the current population being able to correctly write in Chinese.
Well, I guess no one's my book that I'm writing, The Story of the Thick Toad, is going to struggle to be translated in China. Then it's a bit of a concern, but I guess to Western eyes, This might look like a slightly different story, perhaps, in that, you know, the decline of Chinese character writing, you know, it's a very complicated business in the first place, as distinct from other reading and writing in other parts of the world with different sort of character bases. What is it, several thousand characters people would need to know in order to be sort of passably literate?
Indeed, and there's, you know, multiple characters for the same word. I'm not a Chinese speaker, so I really don't understand it, and it's something which I've tried to talk to my colleagues and get my head around. You know, there's the obvious separation between Mandarin and Cantonese. In Mandarin, there are four tones. In Cantonese, there are nine tones. In the 1950s, the mainland began introducing simplified Chinese, which is what most of the Chinese you read in mainland China is now used, because they did that to improve literacy. But in Hong Kong and in Macau and Taiwan, they still use traditional Chinese. And what's happened since the advent of people using phones and computers to communicate, pinyin, which was a phonetic system also introduced in the 1950s, that was supposed to help people maintain literacy. And what it is, you type in the word as you would write it in English characters, and then your phone or your computer will convert it into the Chinese character, meaning that you don't really know how to draw the character yourself.
And do we know how much of this is also being blamed on the emergence of English and Chinese people wanting to learn English and learning to write English?
I'm sure the fact that, you know, most of the things you need to communicate online, and you could do that much more easily in English, is being thrown around. But I think it is predominantly the fact that people aren't sitting down and learning the words in the way they would traditionally have done so. Instead, they're learning on computers, they're typing things in, and the computer does half the work for them. So the convenience of the system is said to erode people's memory of certain characters, because all you really need to know when you're using this pinyin system on your computer is the word sound.
Okay, Aisha, let's look at a third story, and this is a bit of a battle between Singapore and Hong Kong over who can really get stuff done.
Indeed. Well, Hong Kong and Singapore are rivals. I mean, that's no secret. You speak to anyone here in Hong Kong who's trying to attract new business, and they say their number one rival is Singapore. The two places are obviously very different. But there's an interesting op-ed in the South China Morning Post today, perhaps saying that Hong Kong should look a little bit more towards Singapore as an example of how to get things done. Singapore's about to double the size of Changi Airport, extend public health insurance, and make housing more affordable, all issues that Hong Kong is also facing. But the argument is that Hong Kong's government is so tied up with kind of bureaucracy and arguing with each other that these things haven't been done in the way they can be done in Singapore.
And so the idea being that Singapore is showing the way, whereas Hong Kong once did sort of 20 or 30 years ago, I guess. Is this message getting through to people? Is this causing a bit of waves in the editorial columns?
Somewhat. I think the argument is that Singapore has quite an authoritarian government. They decide what they want to do and they do it. They have compulsory voting there as well, whereas Hong Kong obviously does not have universal suffrage, and that's a big issue that the city's constantly debating. So I think the argument is, while Singapore is often criticised by Hong Kongers as being far too authoritarian, they are getting things done, and here in Hong Kong we're just arguing about who's going to have the vote, when we're going to have the vote, and how, and that doesn't lead to problems actually being fixed.
Aisha, always good to talk to you. Our Hong Kong Bureau Chief is Aisha Spears. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Coming up, we'll be discussing the strange case of two Norwegians charged with murder and spying in the Congo.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
You don't write a book lightly, and I didn't really want to write a book, so I had to find something which could only be explained in a book.
Take the Global Pulse.
Singapore is too small to have a known huge art scene to be competitive on a global level.
The old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone.
A lot of people come south for the opium harvest, and literally as soon as the last opium poppy is harvested, they will then take up arms and fight for a few weeks. It's purely practical.
And occasionally take things down a notch too.
I mean, if someone wants to buy it for $100 million, we would sell it.
Our radio station's got quite a wealthy demographic. I think you're in the right place.
To end the week with the best chat.
I've been confused for Kenny Loggins, actually.
I want to start with a very simple question. Why did we go to war with Iraq?
Some great music.
A grand piano is kind of a condescending icon at this point.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
Welcome back. You're listening to Majori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Now, he always protested his innocence. He claimed he was sent mad by malaria during his trial. And on Sunday, Tjostolv Molland was found dead in his cell. The Norwegian had been held in a Congolese jail for the past 4 years. Along with his friend Joshua French, he was convicted of murdering a driver and of being a Norwegian spy.
The men's case attracted attention around the world. The Norwegian government denied that they were spies, and both men reportedly wrote to Congolese President Joseph Kabila asking for a commuted sentence, but the Congolese authorities were unmoving. The circumstances around Molland's death are still uncertain. Well, our Africa correspondent Tristan McConnell met both men back in 2009 when they'd just been convicted. We're now joined on the line with Tristan from Nairobi. Welcome to the program, Tristan. You met these two men back in 2009. Initially, what's your reaction to this death?
Well, I think it's just a terrible tragedy, really, that these two young men have been sort of languishing in prison for, 4 years now. And, you know, Molland, when I met him, it was quite clear that, you know, he was suffering some kind of mental, psychological problems. And the fact that he's been sort of kept in prison for all this time and now, you know, has actually died, there was just really a terrible tragedy for his family.
Okay, I mean, clearly, we alluded to the fact that you know, there was protest. The Norwegian government suggested that they weren't spies. There were letters to the Congolese president. How strong is the evidence against these men?
It was a pretty tricky case, to be honest. Basically, they were accused of killing a driver and then going on the run. Now, they never denied that they actually had a weapon with them. Molland had a shotgun, which he brought with him, he said, for personal protection. But they claimed they were ambushed one night in May 2009 out in the middle of nowhere in the Congolese jungle and then ran for their lives. The prosecution said that they'd actually murdered this driver. Now, you know, on the one hand, the evidence that was provided by the prosecution was pretty flimsy. It was far from a sort of free and fair trial. I mean, they were tried at a military tribunal, and there were many, many problems in the trial process itself. But, you know, at the same time, it was quite hard to discern where the truth lay in all this, because the fact of the matter was that, you know, they had entered the country illegally with a gun, a man was killed, and there were no sort of real witnesses to describe what had happened. So it was very hard to discern where the truth lay. But, you know, what I found from meeting the two guys in prison then was, you know, they maintained very, very strongly that they were innocent of the charges. But really, it was just the kind of conditions that they were being held in that was so appalling. And the thing that really stuck with me was the time I spent with Molland, where, you know, he was talking about how he'd had cerebral malaria and suffered psychosis afterward. His cellmate, Joshua French, talked about, you know, being attacked by his friend during one of his sort of psychotic out. And the most striking thing about it all was the way that, you know, Molan would walk around Kisangani's jail being saluted by other inmates who referred to him as Colonel Mike, which was a reference to this infamous African mercenary guy called Mike Hoare, who Molan kind of idolized. So there was this sort of very weird situation going on in Kisangani jail, and particularly surrounding Molan and what were quite clearly some delusions that he was suffering.
So I guess, Tristan, now the one big question is, what happens to Joshua French? Do we have any indication of whether he could potentially be moved to a different prison, whether his sentence could be potentially cut back?
Yeah, again, it's fairly unclear. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, the Norwegian government has been pushing for years, really, to have the two men repatriated to Norway and serve out their sentences there. And that those pleas have fallen on deaf ears the entire time. Now, perhaps things will change with the death of Molan. There'll be more sort of clemency, as it were, towards Joshua French. And certainly, you know, that is exactly what the family is pushing for. It's what the Norwegian government wants. So possibly we might see some movement in that direction now.
Joshua French has joint British nationality, I believe, as well. That sounds like a potential for shedding some more light, gaining some more attention for this case. How interested or not is the British government in this case?
Yeah, the British government isn't very interested in this case. There's a British organisation called Reprieve, which has been very involved in trying to push for their release and has sort of documented the failings in the judicial process in Congo. But Britain's approach really has been to hand responsibility for the two men over to Norway. And really, in terms of sort of consular support or diplomatic support, there's been a fairly deafening silence, really, from Britain.
What was their alleged motive, Tristan?
It was criminal, is what the prosecution was saying, the murder. But then they also threw in these rather peculiar other charges where, you know, they accused them of being Norwegian spies because they had some out-of-date Norwegian military identity documents. And, you know, some of the evidence that was produced, or evidence, as they said it, that was produced at the military tribunal was just laughable. I mean, they had a photograph that was brought out. If you were to Google Norway Army Africa, there's this sort of peculiar picture of a chap in a beret pointing at a map of Africa. And that was presented by the prosecution as evidence of some grand Norwegian plan to sort of annex Congo. So that was the kind of level of evidence that was being bandied about at this trial, which led to their prosecution. So clearly a very faulty judicial process was underway there, and these two men were caught up in that.
Our Africa correspondent Tristan McConnell there. Tristan, good to talk to you as ever.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Outlondo, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It is 23 minutes past the hour here in London. Now, you don't choose your family, and you don't get to choose your surname either. Yet both are very much part of the person you become. That's the simple statement with which David McKee's book, What's in a Surname, starts with.
McKee explores British names from Abercrombie to Zwicker and sets to explore both their geography, where they came from, and their history, how they came to be formed.
Well, to shed light on the potent history of Dominic's last name,
yes.
Reynolds, David McKee is joining us today in the studio. Welcome to the programme, David.
Thank you. I must say that this book is not a surname dictionary, so you won't find every name in. And in fact, people have said to me, is my name in the book? And it's not. It's more a view of what surnames do. But as for Reynolds, that's reasonably easy. To begin with, it ends in an S. And a lot of Welsh names end in S because the Welsh and the Borders got their surnames quite late. And it's mainly son of John, which becomes Jones, son of Owen, which becomes Owen, and son of Reynold, which is not a name there is around, but it's an old Norman name, I think. Reynold.
You know more than I do already. I didn't know that I was Welsh. You've just totally rewritten my family history in a second. Amazing.
You may come from the border counties, Hereford, Shropshire,
I feel like I do.
Cheshire.
The border, at the very least, probably over the border.
The old Welsh names are actually quite different from those. The original Welsh names were things like Llewellyn, with two L's at the beginning, and Lloyd, which is not pronounced Lloyd, but perhaps it ought to be. and also lots of names which, whereas Mook, my name, is Mook means son of. In Wales, it was Ap, A-P, and that merged with other names. So the name Powell means Ap Howell, which is the son of Howell, and Price is Ap Rice, and so on. So a lot of the genuine good old Welsh names people think are English, whereas a lot of the names which people say, oh, that's Welsh, are not really Welsh at all.
I see.
It's a very confusing area.
I won't ask you what Han means, of course, it's from Korea. Probably don't know.
Well, there's a lot about Korea in this book, actually, because the pattern of Korean surnames is so interesting. And I know this particularly because where I live in London, we're not far from a suburb called New Malden, which is, I mean, people didn't know until 2002 when the Koreans got into the World Cup semi-finals how many people there were in New Malden who were Korean.
Did you know that, Phil?
I knew there was a big population there, but I've only been here for a couple of years.
I don't know quite when it started. It started because one or two diplomats from Korea settled in that area, and gradually a cluster built up. And in 2002, the Daily Telegraph sent a reporter down to Malden where there were street parties going on saying, what's all this about? And they said, well, we're Koreans. You know, we've done fabulously well. And the Telegraph stopped three people in the street and asked them to talk about it. And they all had the surname Kim. Which is
the most popular name in Korea, isn't it?
Yeah. I think I mentioned in the book, I think at one stage where North Korea talks to South Korea, both the presidents are called Kim.
How interesting. Well, there we go. Phil was speculating angrily that he wasn't going to be included in this discussion, but you were wrong, Mr. Han. So give us an idea of the sort of journey your book takes us on through the sort of, you know, what questions are we going to have answered in this about naming conventions?
Well, quite a lot of it is to do with the origin and meaning of names. And I mean, as I say, it's not a dictionary. You can't look them up. But there are certain principles about where names come from. And in this country, there are basically four roots to your name. One is, to take an example, Reynolds.
Thank you.
Which basically means you're the son of somebody.
Yes.
And then the next lot, which are called occupation or office, is a name like Butcher, Baker.
Cooper, Miller.
Barber, Cooper, Miller. Yes. I mean, those names are very well scattered around the country because everybody, Smith, biggest surname in this country, every village needed a Smith. Mm. Although actually in the southwest of England, they didn't use the word Smith, so there are fewer Smiths down there.
Okay.
That's two. The next one is names of which come from places. I mean, basically, people needed surnames and they needed them after the Norman Conquest because the old Anglo-Saxon names had all faded away and there were very, very few forenames, Christian names, John, Roger, etc. So any village was full of people called John. So you distinguished them by calling them John the Butcher or John, son of George, or whatever. But also, you also nicknamed them. You gave them names which you thought described their personalities, so they'd be short or thin or anything of this kind.
Okay, so that's the fourth one. I wonder.
No, that's the third one. I've missed one out, actually.
So we've got places, occupation.
Yes, places. I didn't mention places, but basically, if you're called Bradford, it was because you lived in somewhere which wasn't Bradford, and people said, oh, that's John from Bradford. So he became John Bradford.
So how then is there a hierarchy of from which reason a name will come? So, you know, everybody is the son of somebody, but then there's, you know, if Miller isn't called the son of his actual father, is he?
It's purely local practice. There were no rules. Insofar as there were rules, they were not made up by the people who got the names. I mean, quite a lot of people got their names because as the bureaucracy increased, you went before some official who said, what is your surname? And you hadn't got one. Mm. So they say, right, well, your surname is, and they'd make up a surname for you. And, you know, a lot of people are traced back to names that were made up for them.
But go on, Phil.
Well, talk to us a bit about the evolution then of the last name here in the UK. In your book, you have a list of the most popular names from 1853 and then a more up-to-date version.
Yeah.
Obviously, we have a name like Patel, which is obviously from India, but now it's one of the the most popular last names
actually,
in the country.
I mean, curiously enough, since I finished the book, I think I say that Patel is now the 30th name. But since then, I have just got a list of the most common names in London.
News just in.
Which is news just in. And Smith is the most common name in London, which would not surprise you because it is everywhere. But number two now is Patel.
I see.
Which has overtaken Jones, Williams, Brown, Taylor and Johnson, which were always top runners. And then Shah is now in an 8. Begum is in at 11 and Khan is at 13.
And that's the London demographic.
That's
there.
The London. Because London always way ahead. London had surnames long before anyone else did. London always had the most immigrant communities. Mm. It always had the biggest scatter of names. And, that's increasingly so now.
And if surnames are there to differentiate all the Johns from the other Johns, then I guess the bigger the city that you're in, the more surnames are required.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, in a small village, a village of a few people, everybody knew everybody else. And I have done quite a lot of work on the clusters of names in churchyards, which is how I got interested in this. Ah. I mean, the village where my brother and his wife lived, if you go in the churchyard, you think, why is everybody in this village called Hammond? And it's amazing. Some places, one name dominates a churchyard.
Just before you go, I know you're not a name dictionary, but what about Burnham?
Oh, God.
Does the name, where does the
Mosey
name Burnham?
Cook, probably.
Yeah, I think Burnham, I mean, Burnham is quite a commonplace name. And I would think, without looking it up, it's probably, I mean, there's Burnham Beeches. And there are several. There's Burnham on
Burnham
Crouch.
In Somerset, Burnham on Crouch in Essex, Burnham in Buckinghamshire. In
lots of Burnhams. Lots of Burnhams.
Lots of Burnhams, therefore lots of Burnham surnames.
It's becoming quite a Burnham fest. That is the voice of Barney Burnham, of course, and that was the voice of David McKee, author of What's in a Surname? A Journey from Abercrombie to Zwicker. Thank you very much, David, for coming in today.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monaco 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Now, in the next half hour of the program, we'll be checking in with our Berlin correspondent. We'll be leafing through this morning's European front pages, and we'll meet a married couple who also worked together as designers in Istanbul. And we might even have a sip or two of Japanese whiskey as well. But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. Egypt's state media say the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Badia, has been arrested in Cairo. Officials say the 70-year-old was detained at a flat in Nasser City after security forces received a tip-off. He'd been on the run from the authorities who've arrested dozens of Muslim Brotherhood members in a security crackdown. The US State Department has announced that one of its leading diplomats and the US ambassador to Syria will meet a Russian delegation in The Hague next week to discuss plans for a peace conference to end the civil war in Syria. A court in Pakistan has formally indicted the former military dictator Pervez Musharraf with the murder of the former premier Benazir Bhutto, who was assassinated in 2007. He denies murder, conspiracy to murder and facilitation of murder, and his lawyer says the charges were fabricated. A Palestinian man has been killed and two others wounded after Israeli troops opened fire during a raid on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Doctors say the 20-year-old was killed with a bullet to his heart and the wounded man also suffered gunshot wounds. A train has killed at least 37 people who were crossing a railway track in eastern India's Bihar state. Most of the dead were pilgrims on their way to attend a religious festival. The US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and his Chinese counterpart have announced expanded bilateral exchanges and joint military exercises as the two countries tackle differences in the areas of Asia-Pacific and cybersecurity. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. Barney, we'll be back at the top of the hour with another check of your world headlines. You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 8:33. Now, it may still only be the early hours of the morning here in London, but that won't stop us from turning our attention to that delicious of fermented grain drinks. Of course, I am talking about whiskey.
Sounds like you've drunk quite a bit of it.
Well, many of us will be familiar with the reputation of Scottish whiskey, but a new breed of whiskey from Japan is making headlines around the world, including right here at Monocle.
Indeed. In the business section of our September issue of the magazine, we profile one startup distillery in Japan that's managed to beat the powerhouse brands when it comes to taste. So how has Japanese whiskey managed to beat their more established Scottish partners? Well, to find out more, we're joined on the line by Rob Allenson, editor of the Whiskey Mag and connoisseur of all things whiskey. Rob, welcome to the programme. So Japanese whiskey, We wanted to have some here at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm afraid we weren't able to source it in the building today. But were Phil and I having a sip now, what would it taste more similar to, sort of in its character? Is it of the Irish grouping, the American? Is it basically like a Scotch in taste?
It sort of sits in between sort of Scotch and Irish. I mean, the problem is it's difficult to categorise because what the guys are doing out there is something that's a different take on Scotch and Irish. So they're sort of following their own path, particularly, you know, the Akuta-san, the chap you featured in the recent Monocle edition, is very much driving his own line with flavour profiles and using different casks, different woods, different cut times, fermentation times, that sort of thing.
This isn't like it's a relatively new practice for the Japanese. The Japanese have been distilling whiskey for over a century now, but it seems only recently that they're really starting to make a name for this worldwide. Whiskey magazine named Suntory the first Japanese company to be awarded Distiller of the Year recently. So what is it about Japanese whiskey that only all of a sudden seems to be making the headlines?
Well, I mean, the wonderful thing is, sorry, I apologize, I'm stood next to the wonderful thing is that the industry in Japan is actually founded on a love story, which is really, really lovely, lovely thing. Masataka Takatsuru came across to Scotland in the 30s to actually learn how to make whiskey. And he took back to Japan with him a Scottish lady as his wife, Rita. And they stayed. He obviously founded Suntory with Shinjiro-san and then moved on to found Nika. But that aside, it's, like I said, they're creating a flavor profile that's not really found in Scotch or in Irish. It's clean. It works on many levels as you sort of work through the whiskey, and coupled with the fact that they use, in some cases, Japanese oak, which imparts this delicate incense sort of flavour, sort of sandalwood and patchouli oils and that sort of thing, which is, I don't like to use the word unique, but it is unlike anything you'd find in Scotch or Irish.
Whiskey is a world which sort of rewards the connoisseur. There are plenty of sort of whiskey snobs in the world. I'm not suggesting for a moment that you're one of them, Rob. But I wonder, given that that's the sort of climate into which the Japanese distillers are trying to break in, what are the sort of challenges that a sort of newer world distillery has to overcome in order to sort of win the hearts and tongues of whiskey drinkers?
The big guys have got the same sort of issues getting their whiskey in front of people. That's the first issue you've got. Most people, once you put a decent whiskey in front of them, you can have them hooked in seconds, moments of just trying that. Routes to market for Japan are not difficult, but it's hard to source Japanese whiskies outside of Japan. It's getting a lot easier now. I think over the last 10 years, we're seeing more and more on shelves. I mean, you find them in some of the major supermarkets. But it's just that sitting somebody down and explaining, this is what we do, this is what it tastes like, have a try.
Well, Rob, before we let you go, I'd love your verdict. How do you drink? What's the proper way to drink a whiskey?
It's really as you like it, to be honest. In a world where there are whiskey snobs and people will say, don't put water in it, don't put ice in it, don't put ginger ale in it. To be honest, ginger ale, you should try it. It's quite fabby. I would advocate drinking it however you like. As long as you're drinking, a decent whiskey and appreciating it, that's the best way to enjoy it.
And presumably having a copy of your magazine on the side in order to work out whether or not we like it. Rob, on a rather hiccupy line, we're afraid, from the Whiskey Mag, thank you very much for joining us this morning on Midori House.
How do you drink your whiskey?
I actually drink it half and half with water.
Warm water, lukewarm, cold, ice?
I tend to go with room temperature water. Okay. I have to say I don't thermometerize it beforehand. I keep ice away from it.
Yeah, I agree.
I like to just take the edge off it so I can
put
really
just a little splash of water in there.
Yeah?
Makes it, really brings out the notes.
Just a splash. Yeah.
And then by the second glass, I don't know what's happening and I just drink whatever.
Yeah, you just start going to the second bottle. I'm concerned, obviously, about Phil's drinking habits. We certainly wouldn't condone that sort of behaviour. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn to Istanbul now for this week's preview of Section D. Sandwiched between the Karakoy shore on the Bosphorus and the bustling Istiklal Avenue sits the Shishane-based design studio of Azli and Khan Alte, husband and wife and part-time collaborative designers.
Well, from here, Azli runs her graphic design company Future Anecdote Society, while Charn focuses on his projects as one of Istanbul's emerging artists. They give the Section D team a tour of their studio, revealing their work, their neighborhood, and their inspirations.
This is where we work, and also this place becomes a pop-up bookshop on the weekends with one invited publisher rather than like a normal bookshop. We invite a single publisher and we display their books. We also make it available for sale. Future Anecdotes started in London in 2009 with a partner. After staying 2 years in London, we moved to Istanbul after actually getting married with Can. And initially, I'm a book designer. I design books, and that's what I'm specialized on. But on the two most recent years, we've started working with the space, meaning the exhibition design, display structures, and the navigation systems. So that's what we basically and mainly do, book design and exhibition design.
It's like a typical inner city, like turn of century Istanbul building, meaning like early 1900s.
And for work, we wanted to be close to the production because around us, and especially if you go down here and go towards Karaköy, you can get almost anything made from metal to wood and to paper, and you can find the source materials and lots of inspiration as well when you're going around, actually. For some of the Can's art projects, we collaborate on some publications, so we can say I think 40% of the work we do is together, is a collaboration.
So, I mean, as I said in the beginning, I'm an artist, and for me, the studio is more a place to oversee the process of various projects that I undertake, and this involves like from its conception to, let's say, accumulating notes, drawings, sketches.
My inspiration still and has used to come from literature mainly, not really design or visual work, I have to say, and that's how my mind works. Instead of making sketches, I take notes and write about the design rather than draw about, how it will look like. And things like George Perec and Italia Calvino and the Olipo movement, which is very much about when the words become actually shapes and they have other meanings than what they convey, they perform on the page. That really inspires me, and it still does.
I originally studied architecture, but somehow I was always intrigued and maybe you can say inspired by the way actually the city and the people themselves make space. So I started off with kind of looking at situations where maybe you can say architecture is almost transgressed or irrelevant. So these kind of notions of how to think about public space, how meaning is produced and how we decide on the ways that we live on the city, and also how we can challenge the at times oppressive modes of living that are imposed on public space, and whether our inhabitation, whether how we inhabit these systems or contexts can challenge the ways that are in some ways imposed on us.
And that was designers Asla and Charn Altley giving a tour of their studio to Section D.
You're listening to Midori House. Up next, we'll check in with Kimberly Bradley, our woman in Berlin. And sooner than we thought,
quite
that's
a sad little sting, isn't it?
Oh, so a little bit disappointing, wasn't it? We need to get something a bit more G-ing up for Kimberly. She is our woman in Berlin, as you were hearing. The time is 8:44 here in London. It's 9:44 with Kimberly. How are you, Kimberly?
I'm just fine. How are you?
We're okay, thanks. Yeah, doing quite well. Phil?
Yeah, I'm kind of craving a glass of whiskey since we started talking about
that. Yeah, unfortunately, Kimberly, we've uncovered a latent drinking problem with Mr. Phil Hahn, so I'll be doing most of the talking at this point. Where do you want us to start today, Kimberly?
We could just talk about the phenomenon of the summer loch, which is kind of a slow period of time at the end of August, which German journalists... the summer loch means summer hole, so it's a hole before the fall season kind of starts, before elections come up. Nobody's in town, the town's full of tourists, and you have to really look for news.
Well, you found a couple good stories for us, though, despite it being the summer hole.
Yeah, I hope so.
Shall we begin with the very long overdue and quite controversial Berlin-Brandenburg Airport?
The newest on that is quite interesting. Hartmut Meidorn, who used to be the CEO of Deutsche Bahn and is now CEO of the airport, has announced that he's going to attempt in spring of next year to open up the northern wing of the airport, only the northern wing, with 10 flights a day and a maximum of 1,500 passengers. And this hasn't gone through all of the vetting it has to. In October, there's going to be another decision. But a lot of people in Berlin are kind of happy that something is happening.
Yeah, I mean, this has become sort of rather embarrassing over the period of time that it's been unfolding, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's had four delays, and I think Meidorn is being very smart in rolling out the opening slowly and not making any more promises that, you know, that people aren't necessarily disappointed. I think that a lot of the issues were because of rushed construction, the mayor trying to have a PR coup and making it into a PR disaster by having things simply go too fast and too many construction mistakes.
Well, Kimberly, like many Berliners, I think as well as yourself, you're a big fan of Tegel Airport. And it looks like there could be a small possibility that it might actually even stay open.
Meidorn is actually pro-Tegel. He wants to keep Tegel open. There are so many of us in the city that love Tegel because it's central. It would be like City Airport in London or any of these smaller airports that are within cities. It's just easy in, easy out, easy to get to. There's some speculation as to whether it will become kind of a premium airport for no charter flights as would be happening in the BER, like the lower-priced airlines, but rather the higher-priced airlines and inter-European flights. And made a little bit more fancy inside. A lot of us are hoping for this, but we have no idea.
Well, Kimberly, staying on the topic of airports there in Berlin, we were talking about Tegel there. There's a new initiative, though, to keep Tempelhof Field, Berlin's former city airport, which closed back in 2008, as it is, as wide open fields and no development.
This is true, and it's very preliminary. There's a citizens' initiative that is, like several other citizens' initiatives in the city, is trying to fight overdevelopment. Tempelhof closed in 2008. It's been used as a big open field and a park ever since. And there are plans to construct a library, some commercial buildings, and 4,700 apartments along the eastern and northern edge. I don't necessarily think this is bad since these apartments are meant to be low-cost housing, but it would really compromise the nature of the park. And apparently there's a lake that would disappear. And there's a group called 100% Tempelhofer Feld that needs to gather 174,000 signatures in the next few months to call a referendum. And that would be fantastic. However, when Tempelhof itself, keeping it open or closed, went to referendum in 2008, not enough people showed up to vote.
Speaking of voting, Kimberly, I feel like very briefly we should touch on the fact that Germans are going to do exactly that in about a month's time. Merkel has a 17-point lead over Per Steinbrück at the moment, apparently, but she's got a lot on her plate to deal with. Tell us what one of the things is.
She kind of does. I mean, economically, Germany has never felt the pinch that Southern Europe has. and the economy went up by nearly 1% this past quarter, and the Spiegel reported yesterday that Germany has basically profited by $41 billion because of the reduced interest rates due to the euro crisis. So economically, we're just fine. The biggest issue is the NSA surveillance crisis. And this just keeps going on and on as it is in the U.S. Essentially, some U.S. agencies literally gave the German agencies a note saying that no wrongdoing had occurred here in this country. Yet nobody really believes this. Merkel's chief of staff, Ronald Pofalla, is still going to be questioned in a few weeks as to the legitimacy of all of these claims. We have very strict data protection laws that are a result of World War II and the Third Reich. You cannot use personal data in Germany whatsoever. And what they're saying is that nationally no laws have been broken, but nobody really knows in a global internet, global economy, what information has actually leaked out or what U.S. and British intelligence services have had access to through whatever methods they use. So it's very complicated, and nobody really here knows what to do. One result is that big German companies are really, really stepping up their security. BMW, if they send somebody out on a business trip, gives them a portable, disposable cell phone.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Things hotting up. Kimberly, we will, I'm sure, be talking to you over the next month, particularly as that election day looms ever closer. But for today, thank you. Kimberly Bradley, our woman in Berlin.
Now, we're about to read through the European front pages with our researcher, Alexa Firmenich. But first, let's play a song from a city Alexa is very fond of. This is Husbands, a band from Marseille, with their song Dream. Was Dream there by the Marseille band Husbands.
That voice that you almost heard was that of Alexa Firmenich. She is going to run through the European front pages with us today. Welcome, Alexa. How are you?
Good morning. Where are you?
Are you a fan of that band?
Have you heard of them? I actually never heard of them, but I will be listening to them a lot more now.
You haven't heard of them? We said that you're a fan. That's some sort of strange ghost in the machine must have put that in there. Fan of the city, of course, I'm told through my ear. Do you know what your surname means, Alexa? We're talking about surnames today.
I don't, but there is a village in Germany called Firmenich, so...
Well, there we go.
That will
be one of his three things,
will be one
it?
Of the four things. Reasons your name can have. It's a place. It's good that there wasn't someone whose nickname was Firmenich. That would be a bit strange.
And Han actually was from the Han dynasty in Asia.
Is that right? Mm-hmm.
And there's a Han river in Seoul.
See, when you pronounce it with a North American accent, it sounds like horn.
All right, let's move on. Alexa, let's start with Le Monde. There was some good news for Hollande this week. Of course, France officially came out of recession. They posted some better than expected growth numbers. And Hollande met up with his cabinet ministers just yesterday, I believe it was, for a bit of an end of summer seminar.
Yeah, so he convened the end of the summer vacation seminar. And he basically asked his cabinet to come up with their vision of France in 2025. So sort of a forward-looking 10-year plan. And what
this is like their idealized version, like what they would like it to be by 2025?
Exactly. So they came out with a utopian vision of full employment, quick and easy justice, easy, affordable housing for all, where finding a perfect home will be an enjoyable affair, which I think never really is, at least in my experience.
And mine. So did everybody come up with something so positive and shiny and utopian as this? Was anyone realistic and saying, well, do you know what? Employment's going to be a problem and the unions are still going to be very strikey.
I mean, the whole point of it was to put forwards a 10-year utopian plan. Mm-hmm. And then they said that by the end of the month, they'll come out with a more short-term applicable vision.
So they'll try to at least adopt some measures to perhaps get to that utopian vision that they have in 2025.
Exactly. But the whole point is to use it as a tool to reflect and mobilize France to look at long-term goals versus just a short-term vision. And some of the things they say are quite funny. For example, they say the world's going to go through a third industrial revolution and that France should concentrate on developing high-end technology For example, one of their predictions is that they'll have developed by 2017 an ultra-efficient vehicle.
Interesting.
I see.
Maybe they have some secret society.
I mean, it gets quite close to that old thing where, like, in the future, we'll all have, like, clothes made of foil and there'll be robots serving us breakfast. Like, I'm still waiting for my breakfast.
What kind of future
robot
are you hoping for?
Well, I just, you know, this is what they used to say in TV programs in the 70s, didn't they?
I wasn't born then, maybe. Different generation.
Okay, let's move
on. Let's move on, though, Alexa, to El País.
So there's a festival taking place for the past week in Spain. Guess what it is with the name Rototom?
Is it a... I don't know. What is a Rototom? I've only got inappropriate things in my head.
It's
something to do with music?
A reggae festival, actually.
Of course.
Of course. And actually, this festival it's based on a festival that used to take place in Jamaica called the Reggae Sunsplash Festival in 1978. And it's been going on for 20 years now. So this is the 20-year anniversary. And 4 years ago, it actually moved from the mountains in Italy to the beaches of Spain. Apparently, they felt persecuted by the dangerous policies of Berlusconi.
Okay. And it's got a slightly, by the sounds of it, this has a very different kind of ethical standpoint and a different vibe to it than your average festival.
It does. Everything's supposed to be locally sourced, food, water. They don't have a lot of advertising, marketing of brands. 90% of the festival is financed by the sale of tickets. And as you would expect from any reggae festival, it's peace, love and unity.
Maybe Hollande and his cabinet should have been at that festival. It sounds very utopian.
Well, indeed.
Down there in Spain. We have time for one more story out of Switzerland.
But first, maybe we should just hear what...
Oh, I'm excited. Now that, obviously, is...
an Alpenhorn.
I knew it. The unmistakable.
So over the weekend, a group of Alpenhorn plays in Switzerland, over 500 of them, broke the world records by congregating and all playing together. And actually, the Alpenhorn is a very traditional Swiss instrument made of curved wood, sometimes up to 4 meters long. And it was used traditionally to call cows to pasture or to communicate across alpine ravines to each other.
Wow. It's one of these things that's become a sort of visual shorthand for the country, hasn't it? It's sort of a well-marketed idea. So I presume, therefore, that you can play it.
Of course, naturally.
Yeah. Grade
have you
three
ever, have you ever tried to play one?
I have not come across one, but I would be happy to try.
I played a didgeridoo.
That's kind of not.
I know it's not. Maybe it's kind of close.
Yeah, I guess it's similar in size,
some kind
right?
of tube.
Okay.
Well, thanks very much, Alexa Firmich, for a look through this morning's European papers. That, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denny, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elena Falco, and our studio manager was Alex Funnel. Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs. I'll be back with Georgina Godwin for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. I think it's quite a good thing that we didn't have that whiskey earlier on. I think only would have gone worse based on the downhill slalom has been today's show. From me, Dominic Reynolds, thank you very much for listening. That was Midori House. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.